Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagalani-Albov. Today, we are really excited to be joined by a colleague from the University of Helsinki. This is a topic that I find really interesting, and I'm just being mysterious now. What is this topic? Without further ado, Tony, would you please tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
Thank you, Sophia. With pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's a really nice thing to be part of this network of Exalt. I'm a fan and I know a bunch of you, and I think it's a really important initiative, and we need to have more information and talks, debates about extractivism and all the ills and worries and destruction that comes with it. Well, my personal career as an activist researcher, if you will, goes back until the business school, where I studied my bachelor's studies and master's studies. And in the middle of my master's studies, the 2008-2009 financial crisis happened. And I tried to understand what's going on, and I realized that I don't know anything about the political economy, global financial structures, although I'd studied in a business school. So this was a sort of a deeply worrying revelation to me that I spent all these years in a business school and I don't know anything about the economy. So I think this was the first sort of a crisis moment in my life, sort of realizing that I've spent all this time in school, in the university, all the pseudo university of business school. And I had this feeling that I'm just a common person with absolutely no knowledge. And then I stumbled upon things like degrowth and critical theory and eventually to Marxism and anarchism and all this sort of, let's say, critical leftist theory tradition and all these citizens who were really trying to sort of change things in the landscape of Helsinki, Northern Europe. But it took some time to actually start up with the actual PhD work. I didn't have this kind of idea in university when I was doing my bachelor's and master's. It wasn't even a sort of an alternative to conduct a PhD. It was actually my master's thesis supervisor who said that maybe you should consider. It's going so well. And I was like, what the hell? I've never even crossed my mind that I could do it, actually. But then it was a sort of a convenient way to sort of combine the notion of personal crisis, not knowing anything, to start crafting a PhD of a topic that felt worthwhile. And it was at the time of something like 2010, let's say late 2010, early 2011, when I first heard about degrowth. And I was struck by the word, and it still feels like many people say, sort of a missile word. When you throw it around, people are terrified. What the hell? Anti-growth? We can't have this. It's something so sort of frightening. But I didn't have that. I had this sort of appeal very early on. And I started reading on the topic. And then I proposed a degrowth topic to the very university, the same university, which had some sort of critical-minded business scholars. And they were also, some of them, interested in the topic of degrowth. So I had a degrowth topic initially when I applied to the doctoral program. But very soon, actually, I found that degrowth scholarship didn't have a strong critique of capitalist political economy. So after, let's say, 1 or 2 years in a doctoral program, I sort of changed the tradition, changed the topic, and I started reading heavily about, let's say, the critical leftist tradition, Marxism, and then also anarchism, and then deep ecology and environmental philosophy and all these, you know, the critical theorists of the Frankfurt School and all this. So quite extensively sort of changing the direction. And ever since, my life has turned out to be this sort of, let's say, critique of everything, which is consuming, I have to say. I wouldn't recommend it to everybody. In some ways, it's a sort of a one-way road of becoming even more critical and critical and critical. And I have to say that the critique sort of started of myself as a sort of ignorant person living amidst of the material comforts of the global affluent North, sort of questioning my roots, my position, my privileges, and it's still very much going on. But I've been sort of making my way from this critique of everything to, let's say, building alternatives. And I feel that it's in many ways lot more rewarding. But it's been over 10 years now in the academia and also in several activist movements. And I very much sort of have this, what you call activist researcher or research activist identity. And it's sometimes difficult to possess that in the, let's say, quite proto-capitalist university setting nowadays.
Wow. Thank you so much, Tony. I really appreciate taking us on that journey of how you got here, and as well an insight into that, well, as you said, like self-critique. It's definitely something I've felt a lot, especially since doing my PhD and looking back to the way I used to think when I was younger and all these other things, and as well, like that basis of critique. You know, it's every time, or seemingly every time, I've been part of something that's interdisciplinary. So often everyone is, you know, might even be going towards neoliberal, rah, 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 this is great. Then I go in there and I'm just like, boom. And everyone's just like, this is so depressing. And I'm like, yes, welcome to my field. But we have to have hope to be able to change things. So I really appreciate that. And I love you highlighting, transforming the critique into building alternatives. I think that is such an important thing, especially given that one of the critiques of academia is often that it's simply critique. But I could wax poetic about this wonderful introduction you just gave, but to jump into things a bit, and for our listeners, I mean, you're throwing out, of course, Marxism, anarchism, degrowth. We should maybe put a content warning for any neoliberals who might be listening to this, because they might have a heart attack from all these terrifying words. But, you know, something I found when talking with a lot of people not in this field is, you know, the term degrowth, people really don't understand it entirely. As you said in the beginning, why would we not want to grow? Growth, you know, that's the orthodoxy. Growth is great. So would you mind unpacking the concept for us a bit?
Yeah, of course. Of course, the roots of the concept go back to the early 70s. People like Andre Gorsch or even Nicolas Georgescu-Rogan, these sort of let's say the forefather of ecological economists. But let's say the actual movements is sort of revitalized in the early 2000s. And it starts from France. The croissance is the sort of the word where the translation to English comes, and it's now translated to degrowth. We don't actually have a good translation in Finnish. But yeah, we speak about, let's say, the sufficiency economy or something like this. But I would first say that there are many understandings of degrowth. There are even many different theoretical and conceptual routes to degrowth. And in addition to, let's say, this, let's say, conceptual academic understanding, we have, of course, the actual civil society movement of degrowth, where people are really trying to pursue and test and experiment with these ideas of degrowth. But I do teach a class here at the University of Helsinki with two close colleagues on degrowth. And we, of course, have to give a definition to the students, because they sort of they are also new with the topic. So evidently, the word, we can understand it as a sort of a biophysical process of something shrinking, something is reducing, something is becoming decreased, or it's a sort of a process where, let's say, the matter energetic throughput is reduced. And in, let's say, in the degrowth theoretical point of view, it would be a sort of a planned and controlled process. But like I said, it's also a citizens or activist or researcher movement which seeks to decrease the aggregate scale of the world's economies, matter, energy, throughput. So basically trying to sort of get us away from the current state of overshoot, you know, overconsuming, overproducing, what we have on this beautiful planet to something a more stable level where we actually sort of sustain the activities that we have been doing. So at the same time, we have these kind of understandings. So we can say it's a sort of a theory of sustainable and just transition or transformation of society. And at the same time, it's also an academic field of research, which analyzes and argues the grounds for alternatives and sustainable and just transition, for example. And related to the topic of this talk, it's also a sort of a utopian idea of something desired future community, society, lifestyle, livelihood, for example. So these are all sort of understandings of degrowth that come from different areas. For example, from ecological economics, we have a sort of root of degrowth thinking there that is really much sort of criticizing the GDP-based economic development and policies, basically questioning the sort of the roots of the economic growth ideology, for example, very much connected to works such as Herman Daly or Nicolas Ceausescu Rogan or John Martinez Allier. And then we have another strand coming from, let's say, critical social sciences, critical anthropology, critical geography, which is sort of, we could label it something like political ecology, roots of degrowth. And then, of course, we have sort of lately seen this development of explicitly anti-capitalist degrowth. So we have this, let's say, discussion coming more from a Marxist point of view, let's say Kohei Saito's latest book on degrowth communism, on the idea of degrowth communism, basically. So we have different roots, groups, movements, sub-movements within the sort of umbrella term of degrowth.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I wanted to kind of hinge on is because you use the word utopia. So degrowth as a utopia or as a desired state of being. This idea of utopia is something that I think that we also see as an antidote, for example, to extractivism. So, for example, if we're like mired in the extractivist logic, well, how do we get out of the extractivist logic? Well, through degrowth, of course, you know, because I think that, you know, in kind of mainstream thinking, we're in this place where, you know, it's like the end of the world is more palatable than, for example, the end of capitalism. But I wanted to ask, because is it a silver bullet? Is degrowth the silver bullet in your estimation, or are there sides to it that are maybe unseen?
Thanks, Sophia. I think silver bullet is something that is not there. I wouldn't say that degrowth is by no means a silver bullet. It started from the critique. It's a sort of a fierce critique of this quite silly idea of continuous perpetual growth. Growth on top of growth, which gives us a civilization of the overshoot. We have sort of overshoot of affluence, technology. We have, you could claim that we have so many people on Earth that it's not really sustainable in the long term. We have most people living in the urban areas. We have so big governments, armies. So everything is sort of becoming more and more and more and more. So it's, of course, evident that no word, no movement can fix this all. But it's an important word in a sense that it's difficult to co-opt in a civilization or an economic system that is based on growth. Clearly, it's an antidote. But then it sort of has to go somewhere from that. And there we come with this theory of sustainable and just transitions. And in a sense, it's not that different that we have, let's say, initiatives like, or discourses or movements like Buen Vivir or Ecological Svarai, or let's say the whole web of the pluriverse conceptualization. So degrowth is, I think, very much part of that, but it comes from a different angle because it's sort of clearly pointing the finger to the societies, economies, even households that consume, produce too much. So I think it's a sort of an important component, sort of pointing the finger to the sort of culprits of the overshoot. And at the same time, it has started a dialogue with the, let's say, global South, but it's very much in the early phases of thinking how degrowth could actually benefit the majority of the people on this planet, and also not forgetting the non-human beings on this planet. So I think it's an important critique. It's an important idea, but for sure it's not a silver bullet that would sort of deeply transform this society from ever wanting more and more and more to something completely different. I think that has to be put on the test. It needs to sort of actually become true, because now it's only a theory. We don't have a degrowth society anywhere. We have degrowth ideas. Some people are trying and experimenting with those ideas, but we don't have any evidence of degrowth society apart from, let's say, the special period of Cuba in the 1990s, where it was sort of forced degrowth because the Soviet Union collapsed and everything else. So yeah, right now it's just sort of testing a hypothesis, if you will.
Thank you so much for that. And you made such excellent points. And something I want to zoom in on a little bit from what you mentioned has been kind of in my head. You know, I'm in Zambia now. So a lot of the economy historically going back to colonial times has been based on mining, copper mining. And, you know, when you try to, like, when you talk with people about degrowth here, like say your average person, which, you know, I have in cab rides and things like that, and tried to get into explanations of how this is a good thing. You know, the orthodoxy of neoliberal growth is still so strong here as well. What does degrowth mean for the global South? I know that's a very big paintbrush, of course, you know, not to say that all places in the global South are the same, but, you know, for people who are hearing this, because, I mean, from my understanding, there can be a lot of benefits, but what would you say?
Yeah, I think it's a sort of a key and a vital point for any agenda that is trying to make the world better, fairer, and sustainable place. But yeah, obviously, like I said, it's a sort of a Eurocentric conceptualization at first. It starts from the rich, affluent societies that are sort of breaking havoc of the whole world, basically. And this comes down to the global supply chains and extractivist processes in the global South. Where does the stuff really come from that we use here, and all these questions. So, and of course, this is the sort of well, does everybody need to degrowth? Of course not. It's those people, societies, communities that use too much. It's their responsibility. And if this sort of the process or policy of degrowth is done sort of in a fair way, it would, in a sort of ideal situation, mean that nations, societies, communities in the global South would get a better autonomy to decide upon themselves and their issues, what to do with their resources and landscapes and livelihoods. Because now, basically, we have huge global processes of unequal exchange going on, meaning that most nations on this planet don't get to decide what kind of social development they would like to have, because they are forced to play this game that benefits quite few, actually, at the expense of the rest of the world, basically. So in an ideal situation, degrowth would mean empowerment for those who don't have enough, and then it would mean actually reductions for those that are clearly using too much. But of course, this is an impossible task, an impossible question, because those people with the power, they are not going to let go of that power willingly. So it's a sort of I think it's an important idea, but the practice and the actual sort of execution of that plan is sort of it's impossible to grasp even. So of course, we would need to have a sort of a fair and just, let's say, even global policy of degrowth. We would sort of try to see who are using too much, who would be in the need of empowerment to lift them off from the struggle and an extreme poverty, for example. But at the same time, I have been sort of glad to see that degrowth is not actually a sort of universalizing movement. I think it's more of a horizontal, autonomous, and local sort of ways of organizing direct democracy and all these kind of things. So I don't see that the sort of the let's say the world organization or the transnational organizations would turn out to be degrowth organizations. I see sort of a more of a future where this universalizing, globalizing development breaks down, and then we sort of get back to the local politics and local ways of organizing. That's my sort of perception, because this let's say the global administration government takes so much resources, takes so much energy just to stay in its current situation.
Absolutely. And that current situation, you know, yeah, it's certainly causing a lot of problems on the global scale and different. I appreciate what you've said about, you know, different types of problems in different places and different types of solutions in different places. But of course, I have to ask the question, is there really a local anymore? Like, what is local in the modern world? Like, what is that actually? What do you conceptualize when you say the word local? What does that look like to you?
Yeah, I think the local is different, for example, in Finland, compared, let's say, Costa Rica or Zambia, for example. If you live the modern life that we do, most of the Finns do, like you said, we have sort of lost touch of what is local, because our lifestyle is heavily tied with global processes of extractivism, unequal exchange, resource flows, our sort of breakfast travels 2,000 kilometers before it lands to our tables. So it's a weird time to live, actually, to sort of completely lost touch of what is local, where things come from. But at the same time, we still have, if we look at the organization of La Via Campesina, for example, we know that we have millions, even hundreds of millions, local farmers that actually are mostly producing food, for example, to their local needs. Of course, unfortunately, they more and more have to compete with the global agribusiness that is trying to sort of sidestep them away and offer the sort of the GMO seeds and all that. But nevertheless, at places, different places around the world, we still have people, communities, societies even, that are mostly living locally. But this, like you said, it's sort of on the verge of being completely sidestep with these powerful interests and local processes of extractivism, business, and capital accumulation. So I think depending on the context, yeah, the local has been sort of lost or has been replaced by the global, and then somewhere else the game is different.
Yeah, I definitely hear you with that. And I have to admit that in my own scholarship, I'm a bit critical about whether the local even exists, like if it actually does exist. And I think that one of the areas of disconnect sometimes in kind of bringing these wider theoretical ideas into practice is that, you know, we're talking about different things. Is local for the consumer the same as local for the farmer? Should actors even be thought of as consumers? Doesn't that already set us up a little bit for failure within trying to enact some of these? Because if we're trying to act out roles that even in themselves are completely kind of steeped within capitalism and the capitalist logic, like, can we bring that forward into some of these other things? And I don't have a specific question coming off of this kind of musing, but I definitely think that this kind of question of like, what is local? I know that that's one that I've spent a lot of years trying to think about and figure out. And unfortunately for our listeners, I don't have any brilliant conclusions there, but I appreciate that you have brought up kind of this look at local and questioning also kind of what that means within movements like degrowth.
Well, yeah. Well, I think there's sort of two ways to approach the question of local and global in the degrowth community. Degrowth, let's say in the mainstream degrowth understanding, there's a very much a sort of policy driven, let's say, agenda to, let's say, steer or move or change or transform the politics of EU, for example. So there's a lot of this talk going on that we need to sort of transform the EU from its commitment to growth to something of degrowth policies. And then, of course, we have also this more common grassroots type of activism, more horizontal understandings of degrowth, of being something entirely different as a society. So sort of more of a sort of utopian understanding of degrowth, perhaps going back to the local ways of organizing the economy, even sort of growing your own food and exchanging services and goods and all these kind of things. So sort of going back, if not to the sort of practices, at least the ideas of, let's say, peasant economies or local economies or something like this. So, like I said, there really is no common understanding of degrowth, but I think the global-local aspect is one of those things that really sort of splits the movements into two, because there are these sort of people that sort of, let's say, the alarmist understanding of degrowth that we have to act now, that we have to sort of transform the states and the global power structures to guide us away from this situation. And the only way we can succeed in this is to sort of transform the state, for example, to a degrowth state. And then there are these people who say that this is actually impossible because the sort of the vested interests and the sort of the powerful players of today and the agents of capital will co-opt this state again, and we will fail like the leftist workers' movement failed in the 20th century and 19th century. So there's a debate going on of the sort of the most proper ways to organize around the ideas of degrowth and how to bring about the sort of ecological and social transformation and political change, of course.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I mean, this is, again, such a huge thing. And I really appreciate this clear kind of delineation. Coming off this, something that kind of pops into my head that I would like to ask, especially considering both looking at the broader political approach for, as well as the like horizontal, one might almost say more anarchistic approach. I mean, looking at either approach, how do you pitch this or how do you get people on board, especially from like the working class? Because right now with the media that people are consuming and everything like that, this is a terrifying prospect. Like, oh, like even if you go to the, you know, sustained just transition, the global south being able to get more, then the poorer people in the global north might be like, wait, they're going to take it from us, which of course plays into so many political tropes. And as well, when we see what we could say crisis of Western democracies right now playing off of like the fear of people who are in precarious positions. So how do you pitch either at a policy level or like hopefully building on the like local horizontal level? How do you bring these people on board?
Excellent question, and no easy answer. Perhaps the starting place is to say that, well, the current economy is not really serving you at all. So why not try something else? But to continue from that, it's also that people also understand that they are becoming more stressed, more precarious. Life satisfaction is not what it used to be, perhaps. They are in a hurry constantly. There's sort of looming risk of burnout, and people sort of understand that if they want to succeed, they have to compete with others all the time, basically. And at the same time, they have this sensation that, which is quite correct, that the jobs are actually getting fewer and not more plentier because automation and competition and outsourcing and all these processes are still going on all over the world. So I think common ground has to be searched from the problems of the current system. And then we can start to discuss that what kind of economy we would actually want to have, what kind of jobs would we actually want to have, what kind of communities and societies would we actually want to build, instead of this, where we're sort of forced to compete with one another, where everybody is sort of struggling a bit. Some do really well, but at the expense of others. And then we sort of have woken up to see the connections of our lifestyle, basically, to the ecological destruction that is global today. So, yes, I understand the sort of the short-term worry about the losing jobs and not finding sort of employment and livelihood. But it should be also understood as a global universal predicament at the moment, that it's similar development all over the world. Basically, the capitalist economy does what it does. Basically, it serves the interest of capital, of accumulating more. It doesn't really care about the people on the planet or the other beings on this planet, basically, because it's a sort of one-way street. It can't do anything else other than to accumulate more, unless we want to sort of suffer a constant flow of crises, financial crises, economic crises, and so on. So I think the sort of the spear of the argument should be that we're actually in this together. Some might still do well, but looking the shape of this planet and the socio-ecological suffering of the people around the world, it's not really serving anybody anymore, the current system.
Can we say that again? Ooh, very, very profound thought. It isn't really serving anyone anymore. I mean, I certainly agree with that. But one of the things that I'm curious about, because I know that this has happened with some of these other kind of thoughts about how we could, you know, move into a place where, I mean, whether it's capitalism or another type of powerful structure of life organization, one of the things that I've noticed that seems to happen quite often is that when things kind of come up within the system, they're kind of co-opted by the system. How is degrowth standing against that kind of phenomenon that happens? Is it kind of maintaining its own space, or is it just, you know, turning into another cog within the wheels of the larger system, or has it gone the path of sustainability?
Well, yeah, I would say that, well, if you look at the system overall, this we would struggle to find anything sustainable in it. And you could easily say that degrowth has also been co-opted by the system, because we have a sale of degrowth merchandise, books, conferences, you know, get-togethers. We have degrowth professors now. We have degrowth funds. We have degrowth grants. So it's very much co-opted to the system. So I think it might even be the sort of key to its survival. I mean, capitalism, that is able to co-opt everything basically that can be commodified, turn into a commodity and sold in the market. And degrowth can be sold in the market. It's been sold in the market, but at the same time, it is still, it is different things too than just simply commodities and services and things that you can and buy and sell and be part of in the capitalist sense. It's also sort of a movement like the workers' movements or the women's movement in the early 20th century. So it's part of this cultural revolution. It's sort of continuum of the self-critical inspection of the modern people who try to sort of understand their societies and also understand the problems of capitalism and search for more sustainable, just alternatives to it. So degrowth is part of this. There is nothing special about degrowth comparing to anarchism, Marxism, or any prominent societal movement that we've had in the modern phase of history. But it's important in that because it's sort of attacking the fundamental component of this society, because all of social structure are basically based on growth. Our sort of pension system, education system, our healthcare system, our school system, they are funded by the processes of growth. And it sort of gives us as a more profound understanding that actually our whole lifestyle is sort of tied to this need of making more, having more. So degrowth is in that sense important, but it's not a silver bullet that will sort of lead us to the utopia or a better future. It's one of those things that we might need along the way, but it doesn't basically show us what the sustainable society should look like, or local ways of organizing, or local sustainable livelihoods or means of dwelling, basically. I think it's one important step along the way, away from this kind of, let's say, insane, quite sort of self-destructive society into something entirely different.
Absolutely. And, you know, coming off of this, and, you know, you're talking about local organizing and, you know, thinking about your experience as an activist, can you share with us some of these, like, activities that are going on? How is this being spread in communities? How have you worked around this?
Sure. Well, I think degrowth movement is also sort of one of the side streams of, let's say, World Social Forum, which has this slogan that another world is possible. And I think another world is sort of already here, but it's so marginalized. It's sort of pushed aside, away from these logics of accumulation and wealth and growth, and that we tend not to see even. So I think as being part of the, let's say, the framework of the pluriverse, it's sort of trying to make everything else that already exists visible. And that has been sort of one of my aims and ambitions also in the Finnish scene, basically trying to sort of look for alliances, initiatives, projects that are trying to sort of, approach, for example, food production or money in a different way, basically. So I think there's plenty of things to be found, let's say, in a general understanding of diverse economy, to understand that actually what are the sort of really important processes that give us the need, sort of provide us the things that we really care and need. For example, I've been involved in food co-ops. I've been also tried to sort of reskill myself to grow food. And I have been studying this self-sufficiency school that has been just founded in Finland. So there's a plenty of different initiatives going on, only in the sort of field of food, for example. So I think at first, if you only follow the mainstream news flow or mainstream press, for example, you have this understanding that the stock markets and limited liability companies and big government is all that we actually have left in this world. But even in this sort of really modern society like Finland, there's plenty of different initiatives, grassroots projects that try to challenge and do challenge this fundamental logic in a very sort of prominent and interesting way.
The system certainly does do a really good job of making it seem like it's the only thing in town. Because it's true, as you mentioned it, you know, there are food cooperatives here in Finland, other places. There are ways that we can subvert kind of buying into the larger picture, but does it do enough? Like, does it actually do enough to change anything? Am I being a little jaded right now?
No, of course it's not enough. At the current phase, there are no sort of prominent societal global alternatives to capitalism. And that's mainly because the key players are too strong at this hour. Still, they have too much money, they have too much control, they have too much resources. So it's almost impossible to beat them. But at the same time, we should sort of ask that how long can they sustain this kind of power? How long they have the needed resources to do this? How long this sort of uniform developmentalist, globalist, universalist understanding of this, let's say, global economy or global government can sustain itself, because it's so research consuming. And also we are sort of heading to the sort of the next phase of capitalism, which just might be the sort of the beginning of its end. We don't know. But nevertheless, we know that the global economy is in constant need of more resources, more energy, and it has to replace, for example, the huge fossil fuel infrastructure to something entirely different. And it's struggling to do that, obviously. And sort of these sort of obstacles that this global system of accumulation and growth is facing is something it has never experienced. And I'm sort of leaning sort of into that direction, that we're perhaps not likely to see another phase of global government, but would we see something else instead, going back to the more local ways of organizing, let's say nation ways of organizing, or local, even municipal ways of organizing? We don't know, but it's clear that this system is unsustainable. So we shouldn't expect that the organization of the thing itself could be sustained either. So we are sort of seeing these cracks and breakdowns, maybe locally, but maybe even global breakdown is on the horizon, but we don't know. But nevertheless, I'm just saying that these opportunities for change are likely to happen, whether it's in Finland or in Northern Europe or somewhere else in Global South, we don't know, but it's likely there are going to become more frequent in the future. That's my point of view, just from the basic resource side of global capitalism.
Absolutely, and you know, when you're talking about reskilling to grow food and a lot of these other things that you yourself have been doing. Something I always think of with this, the way the system has changed society, or we could say the way that societies have changed over, say, the neoliberal period. You know, in my experience living in China, in my experience in Zambia as well, I mean, you can see it in Finland and other places too. I know, like, one of the big dreams societally, even though, like, there's been a lot of urbanization and stuff, is people still want to go back when they retire. They want to retire and have a farm and some land and just be able to take care of themselves, maybe sell a little something, but in this way that is like very cultural, but also I feel very in line with this degrowth idea. But I guess that's a bit of a amusing aside. So something I wanted to ask is, like, given your experience, what are some organizations or groups that are working on this in the Finnish context or in a broader context, if you know, in other countries, that you might want to give a shout out to so our listeners can learn about them?
Sure. Well, like I said, I've been studying the self-sufficiency school or institute, which is in northern Karelia, Finland. I think just one good example. And they also have a similar school in Sweden. Actually, it was founded already in the 1970s, which is sort of teaching the basic skills that we need to sort of take care of each other, or if we want to sort of become more self-sufficient. There's just sort of teaching those skills to people that want to learn them. Growing food, repairing houses, making clothes, all these things. And of course, we have plenty of food co-ops in Finland, for example, that actually not producing the food for the supermarkets or the global agro business, but for the members of those co-ops. And this sort of the framework of community supported agriculture, it's a sort of it's becoming global. So I'm in University of Helsinki, Faculty of Agriculture and Forestry. So these examples are mostly related to food production, because I've been sort of studying these. But at the same time, of course, we have relatively strong environmental movement in Finland, especially the question of forests is important to us Finns, because we still have some trees left in this country, although not forest anymore, basically, because industrial forestry has mostly cut down the actually, well, forests that are in their natural shape. So we have plenty of trees, but they are young and they are growing, but still forest, and forestry is a big issue in Finland. So we have many groups that are trying to produce counter hegemony for the current system, like in any other country. But at the same time, like I said, the players that are in power and for the current business as usual, they are still too strong and powerful. So I'm not sort of one thing that I actually find hope from us humans, that we tend to sort of rebel and not to listen to the people in power. We sort of even though we are sort of appear that we are doing that, we go out of the room and say that, what a piece of shit, we're not going to do this. Sort of, it's sort of something that is I've learned that this sort of that is we have this tendency to not to believe or obey the people in power, although it seems like it. But there's something that makes us question the motives and the sort of benefits of this current system too. And even though it doesn't translate to counter movements or counter hegemony in a sufficient level, it's still there. And it's all over the world, basically. It's the World Social Forum, it's the Zapatistas, it's these frameworks of power that seek for horizontal initiatives, it's the Rojava example, it's all these things that makes me truly hopeful that yes, something else than this will continue to exist, and it's sort of a global counterforce against and also challenging the way of the world that is currently sort of so destructive and unfair for so many people. So we don't have to really give shout out from the Finnish context, but because the context could be sort of, well, wherever you are, basically, you can find these initiatives, you can find these projects, and if you feel it in your heart, go and participate. It's sort of, it's possible.
Yes, absolutely. But I think that there is hope too, that even in places that do benefit so strongly from being part of these global supply chains, that people are still, you know, up for and willing to try to do things in a different manner.
Yeah, and it's also true. And if you think about the next phase of capitalism, which clearly seems to be the sort of so-called green economy, which is not, well, green at all, because every piece of resource you have to extract from somewhere. And it's also, if you look where the mines are, well, it seems to be a little bit sort of more fair, because they are all over the world, basically. And it's also Finland, where the mining industry has made a huge comeback. And we see sort of local mining struggles here all the time, starting up. So I think when we reach the point of, let's say, resource bottlenecks and things like these local resource conflicts are likely to escalate, and also it's likely that we will see also stronger local environmental movements also in Finland. So we'll have to see how it goes, but it's likely, because we, like I said, are in constant need of more and more resources, which means that they're going to need open more and more mines, and those mines are likely to get bigger, because the sort of the minerals are not what they used to be. Mines have to be sort of producing more and more waste and so on. So actually it looks like that the amount of land that this green economy is going to be needing is a lot more than the fossil fueled economy actually needed. So I'm sure that this will spark up more and more environmental conflicts and movements to challenge the status quo.
Thank you so much for that. It's really interesting for us and really interesting for our listeners as well. But we know that we've been taking quite a bit of your day, and it's such a fascinating conversation, like so much more we could get into with different specifics and different angles, but we don't want to intrude too much on your time. So at the end of every episode, there's something that we like to do.
Are we going to like do something like right now?
I believe so in just a moment.
It's happening again?
I know. It seems like it's every single time.
Every single time.
You know what time it is?
Question time.
So at the end of every episode, we like to ask our guests the question. It's a sort of call to action for listeners. They hear the conversation. They want to be able to do something. They want to be able to learn more. They want to be able to do something in their daily lives. Just something that they can go out and have as part of their life coming out of this. What is something that you could recommend for our listeners to do?
Well, I can only speak for myself. The change really much started from within me. And it started from asking, what should I do as a person? Well, I wouldn't recommend doing the same, you know, route that I did, you know, going back to the academia, spending 10 years of reading books and arguing for things that I already knew, basically. But I was also, of course, involved. I've been all the time since I started my PhD, I've been all involved in activist campaigns and movements. I've been part of the degrowth movement in Finland. I've been in forestry organization. I've been protesting against the TTIP treaty and all these kind of things. But if you want to learn about the topic of degrowth, I think the best way to familiarize with that is to go to internet and find the degrowth.info website. And it's the website for the degrowth movement. It's an active community, actively discussing the topics of degrowth. There are coming events and conferences this year. So it's a good platform to familiarize with the topic of degrowth. There are plenty of popular books about the topic of degrowth. The Case for Degrowth by George Scalise and others is one of those things. Andreas Meltzer book on the topic of degrowth from a Marxist point of view is recent. The Future is Degrowth, it's its name. Jason Hickel's book is really important, I think. Less is More. So there's a plenty of different opportunities to come and join the movement, if you will. But like I said, it has to start from your perspective, your own point of view, your will to change things. And it's only you can actually decide which is your route to try to change the world.
Those are some good thoughts. Hear that, listeners? It starts with you. We'll be making sure to put links to those books that were just mentioned and also the degrowth conferences in the show notes. And of course, also linking to Tony's own profile if you want to read some of his brilliant academic writing. There's not enough words to thank you for this wonderful conversation and really getting us thinking about degrowth and its role, whether it is a dystopia, utopia, retopia. I don't know. Retopia is not a thing. I just made that up. It means nothing. But thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this afternoon. This was a really wonderful conversation and we really appreciate your time.
Yes, Tony, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Great to get to meet you. Great to get to discuss these things. And yeah, we'd love to have you back on at some point in the future.
With pleasure. Thank you.
A huge thank you to Tony Druska for coming on and sharing such a great conversation with us. Please join us next month where we're going to be speaking with Eya Ranta about indigeneity and politics in Bolivia. From the sunny winter of Lusaka, Zambia, and simultaneously the even sunnier summer of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.